Well, welcome to the episode 53 of the High Tech Forum podcast. This is the place where policymakers can learn about the technology they regulate, because as Bob Dylan didn't say, you can't regulate what you don't understand. So today I'm joined with Diane Rinaldo and Chris Boyer. They're involved in the Open Radio Access Network Policy Coalition and the Open Radio Access Network Alliance, and essentially everything related to rolling out open radio access networks. Diane is a former acting administrator at NTIA, the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, which is probably the most important federal agency that nobody outside of Washington, D.C. has ever heard of. They manage all the spectrum use by government agencies, and they also advise the White House on the whole range of internet issues, including governance, security, digital inclusion, and once upon a time, even ran the domain name service, the root of the domain name service for the entire planet. So, hi, Diane. And also Chris Boyer, who's the Vice President of Security and Technology Policy for AT&T, a genuine industry insider. And Chris and Diane are both people I've known for a long time. I think I first met Chris out in California when he was making the AT&T television streaming service, which was the most highly rated, had really the best ratings in the as far as consumer acceptance goes of any cable TV like service, but it wasn't really cable, it was VDSL. And Diane was a staffer at the House Energy and Commerce Committee, staffer for Representative Rogers, has an extensive background in Washington. So hi folks, and glad to be with you today.
Hi, Richard. Thanks for having us.
Hey. So Open Radio Access Network is something that I've been writing and talking about on High Tech Forum for, seems like forever. And when the topic first came up, we called it white box. And it was, it's kind of a recognition, I think, of the fact that 5G is probably the most poorly understood technology ever rolled out. But compared to the previous generations of wireless technology, 5G is very software intensive. And so while the magic in the original cell networks was all kind of hardware magic, with 5G, we can actually build small cell base stations with common off-the-shelf hardware and with open source software. Does that pretty well sum it up?
Yeah, I mean, to some degree, I think that really what the coalition is focused on is the idea that if you can open up the interfaces between the components in the RAN. So if you take any given cell site and you look at the major components in a site, right, whether it's the radio, whether it's the hardware underlying that and the software that controls the device, you know, as we go to 5G, those can become much more distributed. So they don't necessarily have to be physically placed in the same location. You don't have these singleized cell sites. And so as they become more distributed, if you can standardize the interfaces between things like the radio unit and the baseband and, you know, what's different components in the RAN, then that allows for, different vendors to provide different components. And so, I think the way we'd like to think of Open RAN is that by opening up those interfaces, we can get to an environment, whereas today, you know, a carrier buys a cell site and it's a fully integrated site that contains, you know, proprietary hardware, software, all vertically integrated. You can move to an environment where you can buy piece parted equipment from different vendors, whether it, you know, maybe a radio from vendor A and hardware from vendor B and software from vendor C, or you could even do things like you're saying, like build a white box that runs, you know, open source software on, you know, commodity off the shelf hardware and incorporates that with a radio from a particular vendor. So there's lots of different options that could play out. But the key element that the coalition's really rallied around is the idea that if you standardize the interfaces and open them up, then these other models become viable. If they're still locked down and closed, then it's much more difficult to move that environment.
Well, so one of the opportunities that that suggests to me is that we could move a lot of the intelligence for the 5G network into the cloud.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's one of, I think that's going to happen anyway, because we talk a lot about in 5G that, you know, we have what's called mobile edge compute, where you can actually shift the processing capability, you know, closer to the edge with mech computing. And with that, you know, that's one of the benefits of 5G in terms of the latency, right? People talk about 5G and everybody thinks, oh, I'm going to get a faster iPhone or something, or, you know, I'm going to stream faster. I mean, reality of it is, it's one of the biggest benefits in addition to just pure speed, is the latency side of it. And by pushing that processing functionality, you know, in a cloud environment closer to the edge, that cuts down the round trip time that it'll take, you know, for a device with an application, you know, to reach the content and reach the processing functionality. And that's where you get a lot of these benefits of really crunching down latency, which in addition to the speed will enable a lot of these applications. Think of things like connected cars or other devices that need really fast response times on the network. Those are the types of things that I think will benefit from that.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is that not only does it kind of erases the line between the local radio access network, well, radio access networks are local by definition, but and the cloud, but it also brings the cloud closer to the radio access network because of the distributed intelligence that you have in 5G, where instead of having to hit a cloud server in Seattle to load a web page, there could be a copy of that page cached somewhere very close by to where I am, just to kind of come up with a really simplistic example.
Absolutely. I mean, you could even have a situation, I think, where like in an enterprise application where you could literally have a server on premise that does some of the processing functionality, and then you split the traffic off, and traffic that needs to go to the internet can go to the internet, but you could actually keep some of the traffic localized, you know, in a particular location, depending upon the sensitivity and how quickly you needed that response time. So yeah, it's really pushing the cloud, you know, further and further out into the network. And I mean, if you really want to think of it simplistically, the network's supposed to look a lot like a cloud environment, right? So, you know, back in the day when we built out networks, we used physical, you know, appliances, right? And you know, you were throwing a lot of processing power at it. You know, as we move to more software base, the networks just look like a cloud. The different applications are basically software applications hosted in the cloud, you know, riding on the network, pushing them closer to the edge. I mean, that's really where, I mean, 5G to me is as much an architecture as it is a technology, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think this is, I mean, for, you could say the same thing about LTE too. Like people tend to think of each generation of wireless technology as just a radio upgrade, but LTE really redesigned the organization of the software layers and the functionality in the network so that it was all based on internet protocol for the first time. And in the earlier iterations in 3G, you got to the internet through this sort of really complicated gateway, and because the cellular network was originally designed for phone calls. And, you know, the telephone network is very distinct from the broadband network, but there's been this evolution. Actually, both today's telephone network runs all on IP for the most part, excuse me, as well. but we moved internet protocol right into the heart of the stack with LTE, which I guess a lot of people probably don't know what I mean by the stack, and I'm not going to explain it. And with 5G, that's sort of, it's even a deeper integration. And so when we have this functionality that's local to the user, information doesn't have to travel over distances as long, so that enables us to reduce the power requirements of the local networks, and also allows us to increase the data rate. So it's kind of the nice thing about civil engineering is that every time you build a cell, and you know, especially a small cell, you increase the performance and you get rewarded by also reducing your power consumption. So it's kind of win-win-win for everybody, as they redundantly like to say. And so, leaving the technology for a second and getting back to the policy considerations, what sort of policy issues does the Open RAN pose that it you know, needs organizations like the Coalition and the there's another thing called the Open RAN Alliance to work on.
No, absolutely. And so to differentiate us between the ORAN Alliance, we focus on policy and the Alliance focuses on the standards aspects of it. And so what we're doing is first and foremost, we're educating policymakers on what our members are doing in this space. We want to make sure as members legislate in this area, and there's a lot of excitement around the concept of open protocols and open RAN, that we are working with them to ensure that smart policy is being implemented that's going to positively impact not only our member companies, but the public at large. So we like to talk about the work that's currently being done, showcase member companies like Dish and Mavenir and Fujitsu who are moving and building out their greenfield in the United States, to the work that Rakuten and others globally that are working on. So the kind of things that we'd like to advocate for are public-private partnerships. How can the governments and the private sector work together to advocate for open protocols? You know, I've been working on this issue for a long time now, since, as you mentioned, my time at House Energy and Commerce. And there's a real desire with policymakers to answer that question of how do we ensure a more diverse and robust supply chain. So the concept of standardizing the interfaces, which would allow for more competition, increased innovation, I think is really exciting to people. Here we are with a private sector approach and how to create more competition in this space. So, you know, there's a lot of work to be done. So we're currently at the phase one of our approach. We're meeting with members and their staffs, talking about the who, what, and why we're here and why we're having this conversation. But, you know, it's nice. We started at 31 companies. We're at 45 right now. We have several more that are calling and interested in joining. So it's good to see momentum rolling. And we've had a pretty positive response from policymakers in DC and globally as well. I think our second day that we launched, we received a call through our website, an email from a South African regulator who's interested in learning more. So it's good to know that the work that we're doing is having a global impact, because what we're talking about is global and that all networks are impacted. And these are things that people are thinking about worldwide. So,
well, I think that's always been the sort of the dark side of 5G, is that we know on the positive side, it enables a lot of new applications. It essentially reduces power consumption and the cost of networking. And so it helps with a whole lot of different issues like digital inclusion and security. And but the dark cloud over it, obviously, has been Huawei, right? And it's kind of an irony, because the supply chain, if you look at the supply chain for the components that actually are unique to 5G, they're pretty much all the products of American companies. I mean, it's, you know, Qualcomm holds on most of the intellectual property in this area. So we build all these components, and then, but the only people who are integrating and making, you know, turnkey solutions are foreign companies. It's not just Huawei, but Nokia and Ericsson. And a lot of the, you know, the initial rollouts of 5G, you know, use these proprietary products, but there's no reason it has to be that way. And so we don't have to wait for an American version of Ericsson or Nokia to come along. If we simply leverage the American components into configurations that are put together in lots of different creative ways, where it doesn't all have to be like, you know, you buy the whole enchilada from one company or you don't get it at all, right?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, that's the beauty of having open interfaces, right? It plays to a lot of different options that are available today. And I think one of the key things for the coalition is really just making the argument or making the point that the industry is already moving in this direction, right? I mean, this didn't start happening, you know, a year ago because of all the concerns around, you know, certain suppliers or certain countries or what have you. You know, this started happening 3 or 4 years ago. There was a precursor to the ORAN Alliance called the XRAN Alliance, which was started in 2016. And then the ORAN Alliance was started in 2018. And so this has been going on for, you know, 3-4 years at a minimum now. And it really was being driven by business interests, you know, the need to have more efficient RANs, you know, how to you know, distribute the network more, shift that intelligence, as we were talking about earlier. There were a lot of different things that were driving these decisions. It had nothing to do with geopolitics. It was all due to
technology. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the same sort of technology model that enabled the internet. Like before the internet, telecom networks were very specialized and they only knew how to do one thing, and it was to carry phone calls, and they were all built out of very specialized equipment. And, you know, even, I mean, AT&T made most of their own chips, and it was a completely, vertically integrated kind of, what do they call that, monoculture or something.
Yeah, I mean, it's just natural evolution of what is happening. Now it's a challenge because, at least for companies like mine, you know, for companies like AT&T and others, we're very active. I mean, my chief technology officer is the current chairman of the O-RAN Alliance, and obviously I'm heavily involved in this particular organization. And I think so we're very supportive in working through this. We've made several announcements about trials and tests that we're doing, but obviously we have a huge embedded base of infrastructure that we're in the process of upgrading and building out for 5G. So, you know, but we can multitask, right? We can invest in future technology at the same time while we build out the 5G network. And so I think that's a lot of what's going on. But the key thing for the government to understand is that this is happening. You know, the best way to deal with these issues is to innovate our way out of the problem.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
So part of what we're trying to advocate for is just helping them understand where the industry is already going, and not to, you know, frankly, enact policies that might actually be disruptive to where the industry is already planning to go. Mm-hmm. And at the same token, you know, do things like what was in the recent legislation that was working its way through the Senate last week, which Diane is intimately familiar with and can speak to, around, you know, putting some incentives behind it as well. I mean, don't cause something that's going to be problematic. Embrace the technology change, and then, you know, show some support for it through some of these incentives that will help drive these developments worldwide. I think that's really what we're focused on.
Yeah, I don't want to necessarily get into a whole lot of discussion about the rip and replace initiatives and all that, because it does seem to me that the way you deal with a problematic technology environment is you just build a better technology.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, this approach really leverages America's strengths.
Absolutely.
Yep.
And our allies around the world. It's important that we work closely with our allies. You know, we can't do this alone. We need scale. Mm-hmm. So it's important that we work with our allies to ensure good policies are in place to help promote. But again, as an organization, we've made a decision from the outset that we're not going to advocate for mandates. As Chris said, the technology is already moving in this direction. So it's just educating people on kind of the who, what, and why.
Yeah, I mean, if it's good enough, you don't have to force people to buy it. I mean, it just, you know, it just kind of makes sense. And I think it's the role of open source in this is really interesting, because I think a lot of people don't realize the extent to which the internet relies on open source. I mean, the web servers are all based on this Apache project, which is a long running open source project that goes back to the 90s. I think really almost as soon as we had browsers and web servers, we had Apache. And there's the whole combination of open source software projects called LAMP, mm-hmm. which is Linux and whatever it is, Apache, the database and the PHP thing. And it's like, you know, all the web servers, they all depend on open source. And every once in a while, we'll find a curious little bug in one piece of that open source software. And so it gets fixed, and then everybody's, you know, web server's protected from that particular attack vector just because there's so much of a common code base. So.
Great. So I just want to make, so Open RAN is not necessarily, it's a good SAT question, right? Uh-huh. While there are open source aspects of different companies' software, Open RAN in itself is not open source. So we're just talking about mm-hmm. standardizing and opening up the interfaces. But for the software, that is a company by company decision on if they use.
Well, I mean, and that, you know, the same analogy applies to Apache, because a lot of companies have taken the open source Apache and then customized it to their own requirements.
Right. You could totally see an environment where, you know, you could have a multi-vendor environment where the software component was proprietary code, or you could have an open source setup. I think ultimately that'll be the decision that various operators have to make about what they're most comfortable with. And frankly, I don't think it's not like those options are mutually exclusive either, right? Frankly, you might have an operator might use both in different environments and different use cases. So it'll just depend on.
Yeah, I mean, I did a lot of work, and before I started doing public policy, I did a lot of work in network standards. and where I worked with the IEEE Standards Association 802 project on first on Ethernet and then on Wi-Fi. And also the OSI project. It was a global project that was kind of a curious footnote, I suppose, at this point in the history of networking. But actually there are components of that are in use in the internet today. Some of the routing protocols that came up that were created for OSI. But the key concept in network standards is layering. So you define the functions that you need to have in a network to make it operate over different scopes, like locally and network interconnection and globally and end-to-end. Define interfaces between those functions, and then you create a market where, I can buy an Ethernet chip from one vendor and a driver that comes with the operating system, and then a range of applications, and put those together in either a personal context or an enterprise context. And because I can identify the components of the overall job I'm trying to do, then I've got the ability to go buy things from different producers on the market. We've got some competition, and everybody's incentivized to make their part of the puzzle, better. And it has the effect of, rippling through innovation to everyone who's in the ecosystem. So you're really kind of creating a marketplace when you identify interfaces and you standardize the interactions across the interfaces. But there is a specific open source project with the Linux Foundation and some of the people who use the ORAN acronym, right? It's just that nobody's required to use that. I mean, to the extent that it's productive, then people will use it, or they'll pick up that code base and modify it, or they'll just replace it with one of their own if they think they can do a better job, right? So, and that's the way this is rolling out.
So I'm not familiar with that particular entity specifically. I have to check around, but I know that there's been a lot of work going on with the Linux Foundation on network kind of SDN related concepts for a while. Like the example I know of is the ONAP group, which is the
that's what I'm talking about. Yeah.
Which is really focused. That's more on the API. That's more on the opening up kind of the back end of the network to make it more like a cloud, like we were talking about earlier. Standardized APIs into the network, but the ONAP group is run out of the Linux Foundation, and obviously they're very all of these different entities are all working through variations of this theme around openness, and I think whether it's I just feel like this is the trend in the industry. And as you said, it's not that much different than what you saw on the computing side, where a lot of these same, cycle went through on computing, years ago, and we're seeing that same type of evolution in telecommunications. And it just took a while for the industry to evolve in that direction.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the things that really drew my attention to this concept of opening up the radio access network to begin with when it was, called White Box, is that the companies that were collaborating on the development of interfaces and code bases weren't just telecom carriers. I mean, it wasn't just AT&T, Verizon, and T-Mobile, but Facebook and Google and Amazon were involved in the game as well. And so the one of the, unfortunate distinctions that takes place in the overall technology policy space and also in the engineering space is the historic split between like the netheads and the bellheads, where the telecom companies were sort of considered to be like a monolith in their own right, and Silicon Valley was another one, and they always had Chris, because you live in Silicon Valley, they always had different interests, and they're always fighting over things that, and it was like, did you really want the same thing? Like, why do we have to like wear our industry identifications on our sleeves and look for things to complain about instead of just, finding ways to cooperate and kind of make the world a better place for everybody?
Well, I'll let Diane speak to this, but certainly the coalition on this particular subject is indicative of the fact that you have major entities from the IT space, the technology industry, what folks would traditionally consider communications companies, suppliers, big and small suppliers, big and small operators, all kind of, on the same page that this is the direction. That was really the power of the group, right? You got 50 some companies. It includes some of the biggest companies in the world, whether it's the AT&T, Verizon, Vodafone, Telefonica's of the world on the carrier side, whether it's, you know, whether it's AWS or Facebook or Google or Microsoft on the IT side. You got major vendors like, you know, like Nokia, Samsung, traditional vendors. You've got a lot of these startup companies like AltioStar and Mavenir and Parallel Wireless. I could go on. And, you know, and so it just shows that there is support from all corners of industry for this type of model. And, you know, and I really feel like that's the signal we're trying to send, you know, to governments around the world, that industry is going in this direction. It benefits us because of, you know, all the business reasons I mentioned earlier, is efficiencies, cost, performance. You know, we feel like in the long term, this is a very tricky technical thing. I don't want to dismiss the, and I don't want to be overhype it and say like there aren't technical challenges out there, especially as you try to integrate, you know, if you're someone like us that's operating a brownfield network and has to integrate, like, you know, those, we can do those things and we're working through how to do it, but it's definitely technically challenging. I think the reality is industry is going in this direction. It's just a matter of time before a lot of these issues get sorted out. And that is the way that we can really, advance the issue if we're concerned about having a vibrant supply chain, as opposed to other options, which are just really doubling down on the current model with a very small number of suppliers and, you know, and trying to create a US version or an ally version of, you know, particular companies in other countries that, you know, probably isn't going to be a long-term success story. So I think that's, you know, so the power of the group is all these companies, you know, coming together and saying, look, this is where we want to go as a business matter. And there's these policy benefits, you know, that come with it in terms of creating this diverse supply chain. And we really want to work with government to try to make that a reality.
Were you about to say something, Diane?
Oh, no, just to follow up with Chris, you know, again, right, it's the benefit of the coalition is that we span the entire mobile ecosystem from carriers to, we have tower guys now, 100-year-old institutions to 2-year-old startups in a WeWorks building in Roslyn, North Arlington. So, you know, it's great to see everyone get together. And while they're partners and competitors, we're all working together to push the ball uphill and to advocate for open interfaces. So again, we stay pretty high level. As I'm sure you can appreciate, it's hard to get 45 companies to all row in the same direction, but we do a pretty good job on getting out there and advocating on behalf of the technology.
Yeah, I like to joke about how I transitioned from network standards to public policy because I wanted to reduce the politics in my life.
I can imagine.
We laugh.
And you haven't seen lobbying until you've been to an IEEE 802 meeting where somebody's trying to get some kind of vendor-sponsored system anointed as a international standard when it, you know, might have some problematic issues. And their filibuster is even worse than the Senate filibuster because you need 75% to get something adopted by IEEE 802. When people make criticisms of a draft standard, the standards group, the task force that created it, has to respond to every single negative comment. And they don't have to accept it, but they have to say, yeah, I hear you, and you're a wonderful person, and I'm glad you're in the neighborhood. And
brackets.
And, yeah.
Put it in brackets. I went to PlentyPot in 2018. It was eye-opening.
What?
PlentyPot, the ITU plenipotentiary.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I never even got to things at that level. I mean, I think, as I understand it, the ITU, what do they call it? Was that Wicket?
Yeah,
that's like the ground zero, the most political proceeding of the most political agency.
Yeah.
In the entire planet. You're like, man, I thought I was a political pro. All these backroom deals going on. But yeah, diversifying the supply chain, I mean, I think that's something that's, it's pretty easy to wrap your head around why that's advantageous. If companies don't have to build I did that enchilada thing. I'm not going to repeat that. But I'm actually quite fascinated, and it was an eye-opener for me to realize how many implementations are underway where companies that have not traditionally been involved in the telecom space are actually building, you know, 5G networks around Open RAN. And I did ask you guys for a list, and I got like a pretty comprehensive set of, I mean, top of the list, Rakuten, who known to me mostly as a sponsor of Bay Area sports teams. It's a commerce thing, you know, yeah. In the same sort of general vein as Amazon, right? Or maybe more like eBay or Alibaba. They're actually building a network, and they intend to become a service provider, right?
They are. So the first time when I was at NTIA and the concept of Open RAN came to my attention was the work that Rakuten was doing. So they're building out in Japan, they're building out their 4G network, and it really gives us an opportunity to talk about what they've gone through to get there and you know, how they plan to build from here. So it's a good story, and it's a good for us to be able to kind of talk in the United States, because we're just getting started with Dish here and in testing phases. It's nice to be able to point to the work that's happening in Japan and Europe.
Well, and Dish is required to build a 5G network, right? I mean, this is all part of this complicated deal that the Justice Department worked out in relation to the Sprint T-Mobile merger, where Dish got a lot of spectrum assets from the former companies, and agreed to a mandate a lot of obligations they have to meet, but essentially becoming the fourth competitor at the national level for 5G.
So I'm not familiar with the specifics of the deal, but yes, they're moving forward and building out their network. They have a greenfield. They just announced they're using Mavenir, Fujitsu, and Altia Star. So that will be our first big deployment to look to. So it's pretty exciting on their end.
Oh, good. I mean, it's especially interesting because they're a local company.
Right.
Yeah.
And you've even seen some of the incumbent larger suppliers make announcements in the last couple of days. We saw, you know, announcements coming out of Nokia and Samsung about these issues, and and frankly, they're all members of the O-RAN Alliance on the technical side, and they're also members of our coalition. So you're seeing, I think, a growing embrace of this type of technology.
Yeah, I mean, it just makes so much sense. So what are some other notable deployments in addition to Rakuten that you like people to know about?
Sure. Currently, one of our new members, Reliance Jio in India, they're doing a lot of work. We have, gosh, on our website, we're trying to keep track of all of the different articles from our member companies. So we've highlighted about 20 different ongoing buildouts and testing. AT&T is doing testing right now. Verizon's doing testing as well. So we definitely see kind of a groundswell moving in this direction.
And so does there need to be a transition if a company is built out a small 5G network using more proprietary equipment? Do they have to tear that out, or can they build hybrid networks that are some Open RAN and some proprietary?
I think you could do both. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, though, 5G, a big element of our 5G build will obviously be building on existing infrastructure, right? We'll be upgrading
right.
That infrastructure on a start from scratch build. So, but yeah, it's definitely possible to do both. And I think one of the, I'm drawing a blank here on the specifics, but one of the pilots that we were just trialing was with open front hall interface with some equipment actually in our live network up in New York. So there are some real world deployments going on today, tests, kind of going on today. So on the AT&T side, I think if you look at the other carriers, I don't want to leave out some of the stuff that in Vodafone and Telefonica, who are also members of the coalition, are doing a lot of work in not only in Europe, but in other parts of the world where they operate and looking at the technology. So I think you can see a bit of a blend. I don't think you have to wait, for everything to be squared away before you can do some of this.
Well,
it is technically complex. So the degree to which you can do all of that and frankly how it scales is probably the biggest challenge that needs to be sorted out.
Well, you look at the overall top to bottom organization of cellular networks, they're combinations of equipment that comes from different suppliers anyway. I mean, they're going to have firewalls in them that come from Juniper and Cisco. And there's a lot of IP intensive stuff that's not even really specific to cellular networks that's already deployed. So I guess, when Ericsson and Nokia are there, they're going to support this too. Are they already, are they members of your coalition?
Yes, Nokia is a member. While Ericsson is not a member, we've worked with them in the past. They both participate at the O-RAN Alliance. And it, as Chris mentioned, Nokia had some big announcements yesterday on work that they're doing in this space.
Yeah, I mean, the announcement from Nokia yesterday was a pretty big deal because they've got some new chips that are more energy efficient than the ones they used to have. They were starting to lose business because they weren't as energy efficient as Ericsson and Huawei. But they understand the virtue of implementing these open interfaces in their products. So they don't want to be left behind. And there may be some things where you need really customized hardware to get the job done, you know, correctly.
Right. And ultimately, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about more choice.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, everybody's in favor of choice, right?
Right.
Except when they're overwhelmed by it. I don't know, just like
brain. Well, even then though, right? I mean, that's actually, it's funny, that actually has come up a lot in some of these discussions. Like, what do we do if there's, you know, what if you don't want to deal with a bunch of different vendors and operate in a multi-vendor environment? And one of the things the coalition has talked about is, you know, a systems integrator model where you can bring in other parties to come in and help manage that environment for you. So as you implement an open or multi-vendor environment, there are ways to do that where it can be more easily, you can rely on other parties to help you manage that if you feel like it's overwhelming in terms of managing the network. So again, it kind of goes back to the start of the call, and I was saying, like, there's lots of different business models and options that could emerge here. So I think that's the beauty of it, is the flexibility where you could still do exactly what we've been doing. You could still buy a fully integrated box using proprietary hardware, software, and proprietary developed radios, and you could go to an environment where all of that is broken up and used by, you know, 2-3 different vendors, and running you could do white boxes with open source, you can do systems integrators. Like, to me, that's where we get that drives innovation, because it's all those different options are out there. You have lower barriers to entry for folks, and now you might see these different models emerge, and who knows which ones will play out. We're not asking the government to weigh in on, you know, who the winners and losers are going to be in that environment. We just want to make sure that environment is, you know, ultimately is what comes out of all these discussions, and then folks will win on the merits.
So does there have to be any legislation passed to make this a reality, or is it just a matter of counseling Congress not to do something that messes it all up?
Sure. Well, I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think that there are lots of things Congress can do to help advance. We're currently working with Senator Warner Burr and Rubio on legislation they introduced in the Senate that provides incentives, grant programs for research and development, as well as a multilateral fund that would support grants from our allies around the world to make smart decisions on who they, you know, choose to put in their networks. So it's things like that help build the momentum.
Yeah, Senator Warner's a real gem, isn't he? He's like the only member of Congress who comes from a background where he was actually a network service provider before he got into politics. I mean, he really knows this stuff.
Yeah, and he enjoys talking about it, which is fun.
I guess we recently lost. There was the guy in California, a San Diego congressman why am I drawing a blank? I mean, I've said this guy's name so many times. Made electronics equipment before he got into politics.
Daryl Issa.
Yeah, Daryl Issa, yeah. Should be a household name, right? It's like the Arabic word for Jesus. Issa, that's what it is, actually. Yeah, he was a great guy. Didn't always agree with him, but at least, you know, you knew you were going to get a thoughtful analysis of the topic, whatever it was, when you talk to people like Warner and Issa that understand the tech, or at least understand where the limits of their understanding are, which is something that sometimes isn't always apparent in politics. So I think we've covered what we wanted to cover. Is there anything either of you wants to say by way of wrapping up?
No, thank you for having us. I think it's been a really good conversation, and hopefully this will help your viewers better understand these issues and why we started this group. So thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, I think, the main thing I wanted to do here was just to sort of do a little megaphoning of the concept of Open RAN. So people understand this is in one of the many ways in which 5G is a major advance over the previous, you know, radio technologies and, in fact, previous broadband technologies that we've had. So, Diane, you got anything?
No, I appreciate your time, Richard. Again, we are we're pretty pleased with how the coalition has matured over such a short period and continues to grow. So opportunities like this to further talk about the work that we're doing is much appreciated.
Well, I think eventually everybody who's involved in the 5G ecosystem in any way is probably going to become a member of your coalition. And if they're not, like, why aren't they? So
we'll see. Yeah, that's a good problem.
You wouldn't mind, right?
No.
Yeah. I mean, the more cats to herd, the better.
The more the merrier, right?
Yeah. Right. Once you get beyond a certain number, it just becomes, you know, with 50 members, Diane has done a fantastic job managing all of the, you know, as you can imagine, there's lots of personalities and views amongst the 50 some odd companies that are involved. So it's she's done a phenomenal job kind of keeping all that.
Well, I have noticed that in my professional history, career as a communications engineer, what we used to call it datacom, the people that are most attracted to communications technology as a profession are the ones that have the biggest problems communicating. And that often comes out. I mean, especially comes out in these standards forums where you're trying to get, you know, a group of 100 international players to all agree on like a rule. It's all, but you know, it's good for the drama. And after the meeting's over, you go have a beer and everybody's friends again.
You start all over the next day.
Yeah. I mean, it's like the way politics used to be back in the days when Reagan and Tip O'Neill would have beers together. Okay, folks, there you have it. Episode 53 of the High Tech Forum podcast. This is an activity that we do on no particular schedule. So the best way to stay apprised of what's going on is to subscribe to the website, hightechforum.org. Our podcasts are all up on SoundCloud, and they're supposed to be published to iTunes. Doesn't always work, but it's something I have to keep an eye on. You can get an email automatically from the hightechforum.org blog every time we post a new blog post or have a new podcast. Stay in the loop. What we always do is we talk to people who are experts in a particular area of either technology or policy, and hopefully both. The aim is to educate policymakers on the policy, on the technologies they're regulating, as I said at the beginning. So there you have it. This is Richard Bennett, High Tech Forum Podcast, signing off.